Thanks, Ken. How are you doing this evening? Hope you are doing well. It's lovely to be here. So this week we're going to be looking at good. I'm glad you're well. We're going to be looking at Jnana Yoga. That's Jnana. If you're one of those people like me who needs to kind of see the word spelt in the head, it's Jnana Yoga. And it's the yoga of knowledge or wisdom or understanding. And we're going to be exploring that in all of its confusion, because it gets pretty confusing, which is just perfect. So before we get going, I'm just going to have a consecration. So I'm just settling into wherever you are and closing the eyes. And maybe a little music, see how this goes. So, just sort of relaxing down into, say, whether we're in a seat or standing, and just feeling the base of the spine just falling into wherever you are. And then relaxing the face and lowering the shoulders, feeling a sense of expansion in the chest and then reaching up in the crown so the spine is straight. And from here, we're just going to bring our awareness to the breath. Just feeling the flow of the breath in and out of the nostrils. Maybe it's on the top lip, you can feel the breath. Maybe it's in and around the nostrils. Maybe it's up in the bridge of the nose. So just beginning to observe the breath. And then turning that awareness into the heart. So perhaps that's the center of the chest for you, but wherever you feel that heart center to be, just moving your awareness into that place. And then from here, we're going to offer our consecration. Making our time together holy and sacred and offering it to be shared with all beings. Offering up all the karmic fruits for the benefit of others. May all beings be at peace. May all beings be happy. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. And then taking a deep inhale. And exhaling it out. And then just gently opening the eyes. Okay. So, another thing I love about the consecration is that whenever you do one, it puts you in a sense of it's not you then that you're acting from in the next hour or 5 minutes or the rest of the day, that you're actually allowing other. God to move through you, or you're also sort of saying that anything that happens through the day that maybe your ego would jump on and say, "Oh, that's great, I did so well." Instead, you come to more naturally to a place of, "Well, it wasn't me, and this is just whatever it is moving through me, and it's also in the benefit of everyone." So it's just a really nice place to start the day or end the day in. Okay, so yes, Jnana Yoga. A yoga of wisdom. So last week we looked at bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion, and we looked at karma yoga, the yoga of action, yoga now in everything we do all day long, being of service to others and service to God. And as I mentioned last week, the Gita, although it's sort of seen as a book of karma yoga, it really talks about all of the paths to oneness, the paths to yoga, this union, this wholeness. Really, whether it's karma yoga, Jnana yoga, bhakti yoga, they all intersect. Good evening, Caroline. They all intersect. So we tend to be doing all of them at the same time as a spiritual seeker. Maybe one of those arms will be stronger than the other at certain times, but they all kind of, you need all of them. So Jnana Yoga is, as I mentioned, it's the path of wisdom. So it's a path of study, studying scripture, and deeply trying to understand what oneness is, or what God is, what yoga is, what union is, what samadhi, what enlightenment is. It's deeply trying to understand what that is. So actually, now, you know, we're talking right now about Jnana Yoga, but we could be talking about Bhakti Yoga or Karma Yoga. What we're actually practicing by talking about it is Jnana Yoga. So, and indeed, the minute you pick up the Gita, you're practicing Jnana Yoga, because you're opening a book and seeking to understand. So whether you're listening to podcasts or reading scripture, you're a Jnana Yogi. So you're a Jnani. So even if you think you're a Bhakti or a Karma Yoga, you're also practicing Jnana Yoga. So, as I mentioned, it's this path of studying, to seeking to understand. And the Bhagavad Gita plays really well into the hands of the Jnanis, because it answers a lot of questions. It covers a lot of ground. So, for example, it goes into sort of depth and explanation about the nature of things. It talks about the manifest world and the unmanifest. So the manifest it calls Prakriti. And it's this field of manifestation. Everything's in the field. And then beyond that is the unmanifest, that's Purusha. And then within the manifest world, the Gita goes into great detail about the qualities that everything has, and they are called the gunas. And we'll probably look at those another day. But everything has these qualities that govern how they appear and interact in the world of manifestation. So there's a lot in the Gita that's really sort of works the mind and helps you try and understand the universe. It talks about Brahma. One of the chapters seeks to discuss what is God. And when Krishna appears to Arjuna in this cosmic form, it's really trying to explain to you, like, just give you a taste of what God is. And it's phenomenal, really. You know, if you're, when you're seeking to understand spirituality, or as I say, like samadhi, another thing it talks about is reincarnation. So it's quite scientific in its approach, the Gita. And if you're someone who needs to have their mind worked a lot, who likes to study and feel like they're learning on their spiritual path, it's a great guide, great book for that. And especially to the Western mind, so much of it is foreign. You know, we don't look at the world in terms of Prakriti and Purusha. And even though some of our spiritual paths obviously talk about manifest and unmanifest, the gunas is something I've never seen other than in the Bhagavad Gita. So that can be sort of hard to get your head around. And also, you know, it requires a fair amount of brain power. And you can come away with some greater understanding of the world, although be it according to the Hindus and yogis. But there is emphasized in the Gita very much this idea of the difference between knowledge and wisdom and understanding. And the Gita sort of acts, it tries to sort of portray this to you by, I kind of explain it as maybe a spiraling. So you'll learn a little bit in the Gita about Purusha and Prakriti, and then there'll be a chapter on devotion. And then in the next chapter, you might learn a bit more about the unmanifest and the manifest, and it'll take you a bit deeper, and your understanding will deepen, but then you'll change topics and come to something else. So it's this beautiful sort of weaving all of the time to try and get us not just to be fixated on understanding with our minds, but to let it settle and then to build again. And so there's ebb and flow. So we're going to be talking about that, and this sort of trying to grasp what is a Jnana Yoga path, and how can we, you know, practice, or how can we move towards wisdom rather than just learning the Gita, rather than just reading and saying, oh, now I understand, there's manifest, there's unmanifest, there's gunas, which is really not helpful. It's really the wisdom that comes with it. So I wanted to share this quote, and I apologies, I don't know how you pronounce the name. I'm going to just say Gurdjieff, Gurdjieff. He's quoted as saying, knowledge which is not in accordance with being cannot be large enough or sufficiently suited to your real needs. You will always be knowledge of one thing together with ignorance of another, a knowledge of detail without an understanding of the whole, a view of the form without a capturing of the essence. And that's really sort of where the Gita wants to take you, is to have the essence. And we talked a few weeks ago about, this isn't a book about Krishna. It's really you just have Krishna in your hand. So it's sort of touching into the essence of the Gita rather than just reading it as a book explaining the nature of things and what is samadhi and yoga. And Gurdjieff goes on to say, knowledge may be the function of one center, the thinking center. Understanding, however, is the function of many centers. So the thinking apparatus may know something, but understanding appears only when a man feels or senses what is connected with it. And what he's saying is that when we move towards wisdom, we move on a path from intellect to intuition, from knowing we know about something to this intuitive sense of our interconnectedness with everything. I'm going to come back to this later, and I'm going to read you a bit from Ram Dass's book, Living the Bhagavad Gita, where he talks about intuition in a very beautiful way. So why do we seek this knowledge? I mean, what is the danger of just having knowledge and not wisdom? And one of the things I was thinking about was, what is it that knowledge offers us, that maybe is void of wisdom? And I sort of came to this. I'm sure everyone's come to this. It's nothing new, but the sense that for me, when I study, it is to give me a sense of belonging. It sort of helps me understand my place in the world. Predominantly, though, it comes from just wanting to be comforted. So I feel like if I understand the way the solar system works, then somehow I have greater control over my destiny. So knowledge, as you can see, can be really just a tool of the ego to comfort itself. It eases our fears. It makes us feel grounded when we know a bit more. When we know the place where we live, for example, if you've ever moved somewhere, sometimes it takes a long time to settle in and feel at home. You want to know all the shops in the area and where you are and where the transport is, and you kind of sort of build this expanding map in your head that gives you some sense of where you are. And this really is knowledge, and it can be a dangerous thing. For example, as we all know, the problem everyone's talking about at the moment of the echo chamber, that we have this knowledge, we believe ourselves to be right, and we surround ourselves with other people who are seeking knowledge in the same places, and then we end up with this viewpoint that we are right and everyone else is wrong, and then we're amazed when things happen in the world that aren't in line with our thinking. So knowledge on its own can really not be helpful at all, and certainly on a spiritual path, it's not what we're seeking, this knowledge. So just wanted to read something. This is from Ram Dass. He says, our desire to know, which is our desire for a sense of certainty, becomes one of the hindrances that gets in the way of our developing intuition. Ramana Maharshi had a beautiful statement about knowledge as an obstacle. He said, for men of little understanding, wife, children, and others comprise the family. For the learned, however, there is a family made up of countless books in their minds, which are also obstacles to yoga. I'm sure we've all had this experience of just wanting to buy another book and another book and another book. And Ramakrishna says, only two kinds of people can attain self-knowledge. Those whose minds are not encumbered at all with learning, that is to say, not overcrowded with thoughts borrowed from others. And I say this as I'm reading Ram Dass quoting Ramakrishna. So it's kind of funny. And those who, after studying all the scriptures and sciences, have come to realize that they know nothing. And this really is the crux of the wisdom part in the end of the Jnana Yoga path. This last part is when the Jnana Yoga path really is working because the know nothing has occurred. You learn and you learn and you learn until you realize that with all you've learned, you actually don't know anything. And that's the route through, says Ram Dass. So not knowing. And it's a beautiful pathway, actually, and very weird when you start to look at your own spiritual path in terms of how you start to know and then you don't know and then you, and then that carries on in the cycle. So what happens is, unknowing is knowing. But what happens is you start with this desire to know, and then you start studying. So it could be the Gita, or it could be any path, or you could be listening to talks, whatever you're doing. And then as you start to know, at some point you will stop knowing. And you'll go, oh, this is amazing. I'm realizing that I don't know anything. And then you think, right, well, I'll go out and I'll know more. So then you go out and then you listen to more and more and more. And then you see, oh, yes, I'm knowing less and less. But it's this very strange thing that it's sort of beyond words of that in the knowing, in the seeking of knowledge, you start to unknow. If you don't get caught up in your ego, which is telling you, look how much I know, and you're losing the essence of it, as we talked about earlier. So it's kind of this bizarre cycle of Jnana Yoga, that Jnana Yoga takes of the knowing, and the Gita sort of takes you on this journey as well, where you start to know and you realize you know less, and then you know more, and then you know less, and then you know more, and then you know less, until finally you don't know anything, but you know all of it. So kind of weird. And I was thinking about this evening and just reading through my notes of what I wanted to share, and I thought, oh God, people could come away from this evening going, well, I don't know what the hell she was talking about, which isn't a bad thing, but it could happen, because it's, how do we explain it? Okay. But this idea of the not knowing is the place where we want to be is emphasized in the Gita to start with. So if you remember right back to the beginning, there are on this on the battlefield, and Arjuna is there with Krishna, and if you remember, he has all these doubts and he's very despondent and doesn't know what he's going to do, and he's questioning, and he's going through his mind, if you remember, of I think this is the way things should be done, and he's trying to make sense of this battle where all his family is going to be slaughtered, and then finally he just gives up and says, you know, basically, I just don't know. And it's at that very point that Krishna's teachings come through. And it's really this state that we're aiming to get ourselves to in this Jnana Yoga path. And the gloom of Arjuna, yes, that's right. It's pretty gloomy at the beginning. So that's really where we want to be. Maybe not in the gloom, or maybe, but maybe in the dark, perhaps, that we can, it's only by being in the dark that you can sort of seek to be enlightened, I guess. And so that's the state of unknowing, and that's really kind of where we want to be. One of the chapters I feel really gets us into this mindset of not knowing is when Krishna is seeking to explain to Arjuna about the yoga as the field and its knower. So very strange, but in this particular chapter he's seeking to explain to Arjuna that, well, it's not a strange concept, it's one that we know from other teachings, but that there is a difference between that which is manifest and that which is unmanifest. And one is like the known and the other is the knower. And actually together they are the same. But he's seeking to talk to Arjuna about this. In chapter 13, the yoga of the field and its knower. So I thought I would just read you some of this and then see how the mind works as it's listening. So he says, this is Krishna speaking, I am the knower of the field in everyone. And the field here means everything that's happening, everything that's manifest. And it says to distinguish between the field and its knower is what is true knowledge. So it's only when you understand this sort of getting behind the manifest, who is the knower, who is the real, what is the known and what is the knower, then you start to experience true knowledge and you start to get close to wisdom. And then he goes on, so listen to me and I will tell you in brief what the field is and how changes take place within it. And I will show you who the knower is and what his powers are. And then he goes on to explain what Prakriti is and what the field is. And it's sort of interesting, just as a side point, that the field, the word for a field is kshetra. And then we're actually on this battlefield, remembering this whole conversation called Kurukshetra. So the field is everything. So obviously everything that we see and everything that we hear. And then Krishna points out, but it's also all those very subtle things, like intelligence is part of the field. Intellect is part of the field. The mind is part of the field. Perseverance and pleasure and pain and desire and the senses, all of it is in the field. And I like to sort of picture it as like a crystal ball. And the knower is looking into the crystal ball and everything is in the crystal ball. And even the knower is part of the crystal ball. so a bit mind-blowing. But then he goes on to say that... So who is the knower? And this is where the mind can really start to run away, which is a brilliant thing. So I sort of just, this is why I say this chapter is sort of interesting to me. It's seeking to really explain what knowledge is by basically putting your mind in a place where it's unable to understand. So I'm just going to read this and see what you think. The knower is all pervasive, present in every hand and foot. He sees through every eye, speaks through every mouth, hears through every ear. Every head is he, enveloping all. Though the senses are irrelevant to him, their functioning shines with his splendor. Though Brahman is independent, he is the ground of everything. Though the Absolute has no gunas, yet it is he who experiences their play. And then it starts to get very weird. He is inside every being, and yet he is outside too. He is far away and right here now. He moves, and yet he doesn't move. It is so subtle, it is incomprehensible. He is indivisible, yet he appears to divide into different creatures. He is seen as the sustainer of all, yet he devours all beings, even as he simultaneously generates them all anew. Deep in the hearts of all, there is the light of all lights, forever beyond darkness. This is wisdom, the goal of all knowledge and what is to be known. Know this to be the Absolute Brahman. So I don't know about you, but I read that and I'm like, whoa. I mean, I just don't even know, which is precisely where we're supposed to be. Well, I'm supposed to be a bit further along than that, but not knowing is maybe the first step there, of just sitting in that kind of, he's inside every being and yet he's outside. It reminds me of the Tao a lot. Some of the Tao to me is almost like a riddle. And Swami Sachidananda, who was sharing about the Gita, said, and I just thought it was funny, he said, you know, thank God I'm just passing along what Lord Krishna says, because if I were saying all these things, you'd probably bundle me up and take me away to a psychiatrist. When you're like, what the hell is this? Far away and up close and thinkable and unthinkable, and you're always contradicting yourself. What are you doing? So, and he goes on to say that, you know, that's kind of the problem we face, is that we seek this knowledge, but what we seek is not in the crystal ball. It is not Prakriti. It's not on the field or in the field. And therefore, we are in the field and our voices are in the field and our minds are in the field. So how can we possibly explain with words and our minds what it is that knowledge is. So I'm just going to read you a couple of comments that he gives here about that. And this is Swami Satchidananda. He says, even to speak of it, even to speak of wisdom, the speaker has to use Prakriti, and so has the listener to use it. Prakriti talks, Prakriti listens. So we're all at this level of Prakriti trying to think and talk about the essence, the unmanifested, the Purusha, the knower. And it's something like, he says, a little grandchild trying to fathom the grandfather. The finite is trying to measure the infinite with its finite instruments. A drop cannot measure the depth of the sea, he says. Knowledge of the essence is really only possible through realization. And that's why it's called realization. And you have to go into that reality. So I was thinking about these slokas of he is inside every being and yet he is outside too, he's far away but he's right here, and was thinking about some of the practices that we can do to kind of get us in a state, get our minds in a state that maybe shifts outside of the crystal ball, beyond the field, where we can then experience the unmanifest. And so when we come back and try and sort of talk about it, I mean, we can't, but we've experienced it. So I was thinking about how do we get our minds in a state of unknowing that makes us ripe to really sort of allow this essence to come in and the knowledge to come in. And obviously these slokas help because they almost seem they're nonsensical to the mind. The mind can't possibly comprehend he's inside every being and yet he's outside too. He's far away and he's right here now. I mean, you could sit in those and use them like cones, like the Zen koans. And I was thinking about koans and so the various practices we can do to try and just sort of sit in this space of unknowing and then see what happens. So one of those, of course, there's things you could do. Obviously, you could read this chapter 13 of the Bhagavad Gita. You could read the Tao, but also practice cones. So I was looking on the web for some cones, and I found there were just so many if you look online, but I wanted to share a few and just sort of just for fun, really. So here is one. What is your original face before you were born? What is your original face before you were born? Here's another one. This is a popular one. I've seen this one before. What is the sound of one hand clapping? What is the sound of one hand clapping? It's just so interesting to sort of immediately, where does the mind go? It sort of goes, what? And then sort of desperately struggles through those neural pathways to find an answer. And does it succeed? What is the color of the wind? What is the color of the wind? And then this one baffles me, really baffles me. A monk asked Tozan when he was weighing some flax, what is Buddha? And Tozan said, this flax weighs 3 pounds. A monk asked Tozan when he was weighing some flax, what is Buddha? And Tozan said, this flax weighs 3 pounds. So some fun cones to sit with and sort of get into that place of not knowing. Jim's put his favorite cone in. Let me read this. My favorite cone is, says Jim, neither inside nor outside, but all around. Neither inside nor outside, but all around. I love it. I love these cones. Actually, Ram Dass shares one. that he had. Let me find it. where is it? Anyway, he says, I don't know if I'm going to find it, but he goes, that was it. He was given this cone. How do you know your Buddha nature through the sound of a cricket? And he was working on this for hours in his head. And so he comes up with this plan, because after you do a cone, after some time, you have to go and meet with one of the Zen Buddhists, one of the teachers, and then tell him your answer. And so he goes in and he hopes like to snowball a little bit this the teacher, and he thinks, oh, I'll just throw him a curveball, it'll confuse him if nothing else. So he decides he's going to put his hand behind his ear, like cup his ear like Milarepa would do, and listen to the universe. And so he does this, and the teacher just looks at him and says 60%, and then ends the interview. And so it sort of plagues Ram Dass, because he's like, oh, well, I didn't get 100%, and that's really difficult. So months and months later, he's called by a Zen Buddhist monastery to come and sit for 9 days in these very harsh surroundings. No, it's not what he wants to do at all, but all he can think about is, maybe I'll get that extra 40%, so I'm going to go. So this is 9 days of pure torture. He gets up at 2 a.m. and they go to bed at 10 p.m. He gets 4 hours of sleep a night. He's sitting on these freezing floors, having to look at 5 different cones a day and then answer about them. And if you dare so much as sniff, someone comes around and beats you on each shoulder. It just sounds brutal. And in the end, he says he's so miserable and he's got a cold. He's just really had enough. So he gets this cone. He can't even remember what it is. And then finally just sort of goes into the teacher and says, you know, I don't know. And the teacher says, good morning. And he just looks at him and says, good morning. And then the teacher says, ah, now you get it. And he sort of walks out and goes, I have no idea. I have no idea why, but thank God, now I'm actually at 100%. So there's very bizarre cones, but wonderful things to work with. And so other practices you could do are practices like Ramana Maharshi's Who Am I? That would be another one that sort of gets you in that state of really not knowing. So following that whole way through, this whole idea of sort of neti neti, I'm not that and I'm not this, who am I? So whenever you have thoughts, you say, well, who is it that's hearing the thoughts and who has thoughts? And sometimes you can go around in circles and sometimes you can really just get deeper and deeper and deeper into it. And Ram Dass points out this whole practice you can go through of this who am I? So who was I before I had form? Oh, that's great. I guess that was similar to the, what was my original face before I was born? And Jim's just offering another cone there, or another practice for us. So, Ram Dass says that you can do this with the who am I. So you ask yourself, who am I? And then you say, I'm not my senses. But then one by one, you make the processes of each of your senses the object of your attention. So perhaps you started your ears. Start with your ears and you notice your ears are hearing. And then you draw your intention inside and watch the whole process. And you maybe observe the way sounds come in and then they go out. And then you start sort of saying, well, okay, but I am not the ears. I'm not that and I'm not that. I'm not my ears hearing and that's not me. And then you do the same thing with all your other senses, you know, and I'm not that either. And then when you've detached from the senses, you move on to like your limbs or your organs of motion, you know, I'm not my tongue, I'm not my legs. And then you might move into your organs. I'm not my heart beating. I'm not my lungs beating. This neti, 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 and not that, and I'm not that. Until finally, when you've gone through all of the physical stuff, and then you're just left with your mind, and all the physical body is gone, and then it's just your thoughts. And he says it's like you've climbed a tree and gotten further and further out on the branches until you're out on this final smallest twig, and that's all that's left is your identification with the thought I. And at that, you finally just lop this last little branch off and you're free. But he said it's a very, very fierce discipline of the Jnanis, like super, super fierce, because it's so hard. And every time you come back, you know, maybe you're in the midst of this meditation and you hear something, and all of a sudden you're back to, I am not my ears. And then you've got to go back through all of the sense organs again. Or maybe you feel yourself breathing, and then all of a sudden, I'm not my lungs. So he said it's a really, really hard and fierce, fierce path, but definitely a powerful technique for like cutting through that place of knowing all the time, wanting to know, knowing. Another one that you could do is actually it's Ram Tirth, excuse me. Who this one, instead of sort of I'm not this and I'm not that, is actually I am this and I am that and I am everything. So what happens is you start to look around and say, I'm that, and that is within me, and that is within me too, and I am this. And so you go on and on and on until you are in everything, and everything is in you, and you are the bliss of the universe, and everywhere I am. And that's like I am Sat, Chit, Ananda. I am absolute existence, absolute knowledge, absolute bliss. So Ram Dass says here that in the case of Ram Tirth, he's sort of talking from inside at the end of it. So he's gone inside so deeply that he's experienced these places of himself. So now he's telling us who we all are, all of us, that we're beyond space and beyond time or form. So those two methods are opposites, but they get you to the same place, sort of just trying to look at a chair and say, I am that. And then your mind is sort of like, what? So you're in this place of not knowing, and the mind's trying to work it out, but you know, you sit in that, and then you expand onto, and I am the sofa, and on you go to more and more deeper places. Another thing that is more earthy, perhaps, that I always think about gets you in this mindset is really just when you look up at the sky at night, or perhaps even when you're looking at a cell. I guess you could go both ways, the microcosm and the macrocosm. And when you really start to contemplate like the depths of the universe, how insignificant we are, or you start to think about time travel and black holes, I find unless you're, you know, an astrophysicist, your mind tends just to go, what? and gets you in that beautiful place. So that's something I like to do, is just often go out and look outside and look up at night and just sit in that, because you'll notice when you do that, or even, you know, when you're looking at a sunset perhaps, or at the ocean, or sometimes in nature, the mind just can't comprehend what's really happening. So it can't begin to fathom the billions of years that it's taken for all this to occur. So it's a good place to then meditate and try and sort of enjoy that place of not knowing. Okay, where are we now? Right. So being in this place of not knowing. I was saying this place of not knowing is really where we start, even though it seems to sort of occur again and again and again on our path of yoga. It is the place where we can always try and come from. As you know, we talked about Arjuna, he's only given these teachings when he's in a place of not knowing. And so it's really in putting ourselves into this place of not knowing that we then become wide open to the teaching. I was thinking about my own life and all the times I've had sort of big like epiphanies or like aha moments where I've then come back to Prakriti and not been able to explain any of it, have always occurred when I'm absorbing something entirely new. So I remember once I went to, someone recommended I go to this quantum healing event. And it was held over a weekend. And for the first 2 hours of this quantum healing event, the speaker talked about what we didn't know about the world. So I guess you could have said it was a little conspiracy theory, but you know, he was talking so fast, you really couldn't keep up. But he was talking about, you know, did you know that E equals MC squared wasn't actually a fact? And you sort of go, what? And did you know that these events didn't occur? And did you know the history of the United States is not as we're told? And did you know that the moon, blah, blah, blah? And on and on he goes. And I guess it's how people felt when they were told the earth wasn't flat. I don't know. But it was so much coming at you for 2 hours of you just constantly going, what? 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 And the mind just not knowing where to go. So then when he began with this sort of initiation and then this healing practice and teaching, you came away and I mean, I was in a totally different, like, altered state. And it wasn't very comfortable, I have to say, because I just felt very ungrounded and didn't know where the hell I was. And I was seeing peacocks instead of pigeons, and the world, I could sort of see the atomic particles. It was bizarre. The atomic structure. But I understood that what he'd done was get us really in a place of just not knowing, of complete openness, which can be dangerous if you're in the wrong hands to be in that state. And then other times in my life, I realized I've had these moments when I'm learning something new. I went to a yoga retreat, my first yoga retreat ever, and was learning so many interesting things that I'd never heard of before, that I was really in a state of awe and wonder, and my mind was so open that really when I was then practicing yoga that week, I was able to have much, much deeper experiences. So a really beautiful practice, this Jnana Yoga of trying not to know. Okay. And then I just wanted to share from Swami Sachidananda talks about the scripture and the point of scripture. And Krishna talks about the point of scripture. So I'm just going to tell you what he says in the Gita. And he says, for those already enlightened, the scriptures are as useful as a water reservoir during a flood. Which I think is a really great thing to say, because while he's saying, you know, you're reading scripture now, and I'm advising you as a Jnana Yogi to read scripture and to study on your spiritual path, but I'm telling you, it's kind of useless once you're there. It's not the scripture itself. So Swami Sachidananda says, to an enlightened person, all the scriptures are useless. When there's water everywhere, what's the use of a well or even a reservoir? A reservoir is needed only when there's no water. Then at least you have something to drink. But when there's water everywhere, who cares? And that's the same way for an enlightened person. Everything is there. He knows what's what by having known or not known what was what. There's no need for scriptures to tell him. And that doesn't mean that their point is not the truth exactly. So that doesn't mean that scriptures are unnecessary. They are like a ladder. The one who's gone up doesn't need a ladder anymore. But what about the others on the ground? They have to go up. So at least for their sake, keep the ladder, which I thought was a really beautiful way of looking at it. And then he also has this other analogy later where he says that the scripture, you need the story until you get to the truth. And once you get to the truth, which was the only reason the story was told, it was the only reason you were studying, then you just don't need it anymore. So it's really sort of drumming in that everything you're reading and everything you're studying on your path to awakening isn't it, as Jim says, that they're just pointers. And then he has this analogy, which I just love. He says, these stories and, you know, the study is like scaffolding. You need the scaffolding to construct the main building. But once you build it, take away the scaffolding. He also says, you can think of it like a lollipop. The stick is the scaffolding that holds the candy, but finish the candy and throw the stick away. And he points out that this is all beautifully explained by Sri Swami Vivekananda, who says that all the temples and the dogmas and the worship and the different yogas are just walking sticks and crutches. If you are limping, take any aid that helps, but remember, it's just a crutch. When you can really walk, throw the crutch away. It's an insanity to carry crutches when you walk well, which is why at a certain level you don't have to go to temple or church. You don't really have to do anything, but yet we do. So again, that's that sort of, we do, but we don't have to, but we do have to. So we do have to until we don't have to anymore. We're not there yet. So what does it take to be this person? What does it take to be this like growing sage, or someone who is moving towards the not knowing and then knowing and not knowing and knowing and knowing the feel, the knower and the known? the Gita gives a list of all the qualities of that person. And I'm just going to read a few of those to you now, because I think it's worth going with. At a certain level, says Jim, going within is all there is. Yeah, but it's true. At a certain level, you've got to go, like Ram Dass did, like, oh, what the hell? I give up. I'm going in. There are these qualities, it says, that constitute wisdom, like wisdom, not knowledge, but wisdom. And the qualities opposed to them are ignorance. This is in chapter 13, also in the chapter of the field of the knower and the known. And it says, they are marked by humility, a lack of hypocrisy, harmlessness, forgivingness, uprightness, service, purity of mind, steadfastness, self-control. They're indifferent to sense objects, they don't get carried away by what they hear and see. They're not egotistical. They understand the pains and the evils that are inherent in mortal life, and they understand birth and illness and old age and death. They're non-attached. They don't identify with the self. They are constantly equal-minded in desirable and undesirable circumstances, and they have unswerving devotion to me by the yoga of non-separativeness. And they persevere in self-knowledge, and they meditate, and they discover the true essence or meaning therein. So I just thought this was really lovely when we're thinking of things to cultivate. And sometimes, reading this list, you can go, wow, I'm quite far away from being these things. But at least someone's telling me what I can aim for. That's the beauty of Jnana Yoga. I can look at something to study towards and then eventually let go. But the one that really stands out to me is the first one, and Sanskrit doesn't muck around. If it mentions it first, it's the most important, and that's humility. And it makes sense, because when we are humbled, we are in awe and we are in wonder, and then our minds are more open and can be in this place of not knowing. And when we're in that place of not knowing, more can come in. So I sort of felt like really the biggest trait here to practice as we're sort of moving towards being in this state of I don't know, is this constant humbleness. Okay, so I just wanted to end this evening, I know we've got another 15 minutes, but I wanted to end this evening by just reading from Ram Dass, talking about intuition, because he does it far better than me, so I'm just going to read what he says. But he says something really beautiful about the whole point of Jnana Yoga and what it is, and moving from intellect into intuition. So here we go. So if you remember, we talked earlier about what Gurdjieff says, and that this, as we move towards wisdom, we move on a path from intellect to intuition, from knowing we know about something to an intuitive sense of our interconnectedness with everything. Intuitive wisdom is a non-conceptual appreciation of something through becoming one with it. And that's a deeper way of understanding things and a doorway to becoming wisdom. So then he goes on. In each of the Jnana Yoga practices, whether it's Zen cones or practicing Who Am I, or I am that and that and that and that, he says we see that there are tools that are able to take us outside of the rational mind by way of the rational mind. And that's the interesting trick in Jnana Yoga, that the practices are very carefully designed systems that use the intellect as the lever for freeing ourselves from the intellect's control. Isn't that exquisite? When we follow any of these techniques, any of these Jnana practices, and start turning the mind inward, what our intellect and our knowledge brings us to is the sense that there is within us a light, a consciousness, an awareness, a knowledge of how it all is. And that's true, and I'm sure many of you, I'm sure all of you, have had that, that at some point we just know that there is something there. We just know. We can't put our words to it, and we're not supposed to. That there's something already within us, already there. So we see it's not a question of acquiring something new, not acquiring knowledge. So knowledge is often, as you say, Jim says here, knowledge is gathering facts. Wisdom is living love. So it's not that we don't have this, we don't have to acquire anything. We just have to let go of all the stuff we don't need anymore and all the stuff that's getting in the way, which is, you know, all the thoughts and the I know and I know and I know, of putting ourselves in a place of not having that. So once we recognize that, says Ram Dass, our whole life becomes a process of shedding the veils that come between us and that awareness. Our yearning to do that, to be rid of whatever stuff it is that's keeping us separate, leads us to begin paying more attention to the inner voice of our intuition, because that's the clue to what we should be doing. We start to listen for the tiny intuitive whisper that the Quakers call the still small voice within. I didn't know that was the Quakers. In shifting our focus that way, in turning from knowledge to intuition, we actually make a shift in our whole relationship with the universe. And I love this bit. Knowledge is objective. We know about something. An intuitive relationship with the universe isn't objective, anything but. It's a subjective relationship. We're all in it together. And that's getting very close to the concept of oneness and the description of the Atman, or, you know, the Absolute. And we talked a little bit about this last night. If you were there, we just mentioned about being in communion rather than seeing the subject object, which we've become, you know, trained to do, is moving out of that and moving into communion with all. And it's by, you know, your knowledge is always about something. So there's always that subject object relationship there when it comes to knowledge. But lack of knowledge, or rather not ignorance, but being in a state of no knowledge, is when we're communion. Sorry, I'm just reading on here. He talks about his drug experience. My first experience, he says, of that inner feeling of oneness was when he took psilocybin, because Ram Dass sort of reached samadhi the first time when he was taking hallucinogenics. And that sort of led him off his journey to India and to find a guru and to understand better the experience he had. So he says in the course of that experience, he was ripped out of being a knower of objective knowledge. And he was a Harvard professor, so imagine what that was like. Torn out of seeing the entire world, even myself, he says, as an object external to me. So he understood that he was the knower and the known. With the mushrooms, he says, it all became subjective and internal matter. And that experience of inner truth was so powerful that there is a part of me that never returned. Of course, he says, a lot did return. A few days later, it was all just another memory of something that happened, one more mouldering butterfly in my collection. But even though the memory faded, the experience itself had carried such a powerful sense of validity that there wasn't a chance it would be completely lost. And that's what I was talking about earlier, that we have these, we seek to know, and then we have this experience of wisdom and not knowing. And that experience of the wisdom spurs us to then get back to studying and practicing and being back in the know. And then we have a deeper experience of wisdom. So it's this beautiful cycle, or sort of movement and flow between the two, and eventually the wisdom is the one that lasts with us longer. So he goes on, after a breakthrough like that, we're literally never the same again. And from then on, our lives are lived as a way of getting on with it, as a way of getting rid of whatever it is that's keeping us trapped in those thinking minds. That's right, Jim points out that, you know, drugs do give you that experience, but you can't hold on to it, which is why so many people lose their minds, or they end up trying to travel the world, trying to find out what it was. And, you know, certainly at the time of Ram Dass, a lot of people were turning up in India after LSD experiences, trying to work out what it was, and to keep that all the time, have that experience all the time. So he says, you know, we started looking for tools we can use to do that, and we use our actions in the world as the karma yoga, and we look for practices and techniques to part the veils, and that's all yoga is. It's just looking at these different ways of coming through. It's devotion and bhakti, or karma and serving others, or jnana, sort of studying to not study. All these methods, as they all start to work, says Ram Dass, they take us outside of the rational mind that even created them. And that is the vision and wisdom that Krishna talks about, to be extricated from that flood of thoughts and sense data that is always rushing through us, carrying us along, so that we can turn back inward and turn back to the Atman. And when we can do that, when we can see beyond all the slide projections of who I am and who you are, when we can look past all the overlay of our habitual thought, we find to our surprise that there is only one of us. It's mind-blowing. We find to our surprise there is only one of us. We find that it's all an internal matter, and that it's always just God dancing with God. So beautiful. So beautiful. I always, I think, oh, karma yoga is the definite path. I just love karma yoga. And then I was talking about bhakti yoga last week. I was like, oh, no, I'm definitely a bhakti. And then this week I was reading about jnana yoga. I was like, oh, no, I'm definitely jnana yoga. Which is the beauty of yoga. There's room for them all. And as I mentioned at the beginning, they all kind of knock up against each other and complement each other. So that's it really. That's all I wanted to share this evening. I don't know if anyone has any questions they want to share, or any stories they want to share. If they don't, I thought for just 5 more minutes before I pass back to Ken and then on to Caroline, we could listen to some music, although I was struggling to play some music there, but I'll try again. Listen to some music and sit with a cone. Let me just pull one up. Let's pick one of the ones that we've done, mentioned before. Okay. Or maybe you have your own you like. You could always... Okay. So here's the cone we're going to work with. So maybe just getting yourself in a place of like, oh yeah, I'm looking up at the stars and my mind is blown right now and expansive, and now I'm going to look at this cone. When the many are reduced to one, to what is the one reduced? When the many are reduced to one, to what is the one reduced? And we're just going to sit with it and observe how the mind tries to solve it and just allow it to go wherever it wants. Okay, when the many are reduced to one, to what is the one reduced? Okay, let's see if we have some music. Thank you. hopefully no one has the answer. We're just able to watch our minds try and grasp at something for a couple of minutes. But it was a pleasure to be here this evening. Thank you very much. I hope you all have a blessed week, and I look forward to joining with you next week. So beautiful evening to you all. Namaste. And over to you, Ken.